This meeting is now being recorded.
Hi, this is Megan with the American Immigration Council. Thanks for joining us for this call. Everybody's lines except for the speakers have been muted and they will remain muted throughout the entire call. To unmute your phone at the end of the call when there's an opportunity to ask questions, hit star 6. Also, this call is being recorded. And with that, I will turn it over to Guillermo. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the call. I'm Guillermo Cantor, Deputy Director of Research at the American Immigration Council, and I'm very pleased to be introducing and moderating this briefing today, especially given the quality of our speakers and the timeliness of the topics that we will be covering. As indicated in the invitation, the purpose of this call is to provide an overview of the recent executive orders related to immigration, as well as discuss some lines of research that will be relevant in the current context. We have a lot of participants on this call today, which speaks to the research community's avid interest for these kinds of discussions. I am joined today by four remarkable speakers, and each of them will give a short presentation, after which the participants will be able to ask questions. Our four speakers today are Royce Bernstein-Murray, who is the Policy Director at the American Immigration Council. We also have Joe Heyman, who is the Director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies at the University of Texas, El Paso. We have Tom Wong, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and Shoba Wadia, who is the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinic Professor of Law at Penn State Law. And before we start with the presentation, I want to note that this call is being recorded, as my colleague said. And with that, we'll get started. So we'll start with Royce Murray, who is going to give us an overview of the three executive orders. So, Royce, all yours.
Thank you, Guillermo. So I wanted to, as Guillermo said, provide you with an overview of what the three immigration executive orders have done to our immigration landscape, and then allow the others on this panel to talk with you about possible lines of research or further inquiry into these issues. These executive orders that were announced in late January did a lot of things, and I will really just provide a cursory overview of these issues, knowing, you know, admitting up front that I may be leaving out some details just in the interest of time. But certainly the executive orders do focus a great deal on themes around national security and public safety, following up on a lot of the campaign rhetoric to provide extreme vetting and to treat immigrants harshly. So the first of the three executive orders I want to reference is the one that is most commonly referred to as the one that instituted a ban on the refugee program, as well as a ban on travel for nationals from 7 Muslim-majority countries. And I'll just provide a quick overview of what that executive order seeks to accomplish. First of all, regarding the refugee program, it announced a suspension of the U.S. refugee program for 120 days and included an additional indefinite suspension for Syrian refugees. It also said that if and when the refugee program resumes, the refugee admissions would be limited to 50,000 instead of the 110,000 refugee admissions that were planned from the start of the fiscal year under the Obama administration. There is an exception built in to this ban for those who are religious minorities in the country from which they come. It's unclear exactly how that would be interpreted, whether sects of certain religions. I think the expectation, although it could obviously be interpreted a variety of ways, the expectation is that's designed to limit the admission of refugees from Muslim countries, regardless of sect. The other key piece of this executive order is a ban on travel for nationals of seven countries for 90 days, namely Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. There were exceptions that were announced after the very sort of hasty and haphazard announcement, which took immediate effect. And they have since said that, the administration has since said that Iraqi translators who, you know, and others who have assisted the U.S. military overseas would be exempted, as would those who have green cards and would be returning to the United States from travel. And then the third exemption has been made for dual nationals, that they would be treated based on the nationality of the passport that they are traveling on. All of this, much of the litigation everyone has heard about in the news really pertains to this executive order. So I won't begin to explain all of the litigation, but just suffice it to say that in many regards, this executive order is on hold. The variety of lawsuits target different subsets of these populations, different parts of the order, and so we will see. But the intent of this order, if it indeed goes forward in full force, and we will see if they issue a new one possibly by the end of this week, will be to review the security procedures and the vetting procedures and ostensibly improve those procedures, and if and when they reach an acceptable kind of vetting in the eyes of a number of different departments within the government, then these programs and these bans could be lifted, or the refugee program could be resumed and the ban on travel would be lifted. So, again, the litigation has impacted the implementation of this order, but I wanted to speak to the intent of the order. The two other orders, which have gotten less attention because of the immediate impact of the refugee and Muslim bans, were the other orders on border and interior enforcement. The border executive order directs the Department of Homeland Security to begin to assess the ability to commence building the wall that was promised on the campaign, a wall along the southern border. And while it doesn't exactly say build the whole wall now, it does speak to a desire to obtain operational control over the border, to see what financial resources are available, and to begin to look at the logistics and feasibility and possibly begin constructing that wall with existing resources. We are anticipating, with estimates of the wall now being over $21 billion, we will see exactly how much they have on hand to even begin a small chunk of that wall. But that was to make good on that promise as well. The border executive order also directed the Department of Homeland Security to hire an additional 5,000 Border Patrol agents, which, of course, will also be subject to financial limitations. In terms of processing, there are some significant additions here that really kind of bleed into the interior enforcement a bit. For some of you may be familiar with the process known as expedited removal. Essentially, it is a summary removal process that keeps someone out of a courtroom. They don't get reviewed before an immigration judge, and if they don't have proper documents, when they arrive, they can be, through the judgment of an immigration officer, they can be expeditiously removed with very limited review. There has been statutory authority that has not been fully exercised until now, and the executive order basically says that you should be able to apply this expedited procedure throughout the entirety of the country, not just limited to a border region, but that it could be anywhere within the United States, and it could be applied against individuals who have not been here or who've only been here up to 2 years. So there will be challenges when they begin to apply expedited removal to see who gets caught in that net and how difficult it is for someone to really allege that they have been here, and how do they demonstrate that they have been here longer than 2 years and should not be subject. There are additional provisions regarding increasing detention facilities at or near the border, as well as increasing the use of detention more universally for those who have been apprehended. We are also anticipating through this border executive order a more limited use of parole authority and a heightened standard for protection screenings that are done at the border. Some of you are familiar, one of the ways that protection claims get assessed at the border if someone claims a fear of return is that they go through a credible fear process. And that's a quick screening to assess whether an asylum interview is essentially needed, and we're expecting those standards to be heightened. Very quickly, I just want to note on the interior enforcement executive order, which we fear will have the biggest impact on the immigrants already here, is a radical change to enforcement priorities in that there basically are none. They list a lot of different people who could be priorities, and in doing so, they don't rank them in terms of there's no first or second priority, and they also manage to encompass all of the, basically all of the 11 million undocumented in their prioritization, making it basically open season on immigrants. The order talks about encouraging the use of prosecuting immigrants for illegal entry and reentry, something done now as Operation Streamline, but could be expanded. It envisions punishing sanctuary jurisdictions, so those jurisdictions who are seen as not cooperating on immigration enforcement could have federal funding taken away. And there's an anticipated expansion of cooperation between ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Agency, with state and local law enforcement through the 287G program, which is a way in which local police are deputized to enforce immigration, as well as Secure Communities, which was a predecessor program that facilitated information sharing and the holding of immigrants by state and local officials for immigration. Finally, the order directs the hiring of 10,000 additional ICE officers to facilitate these enforcement actions and deportations. So there are many details that I have unfortunately had to leave out here in this quick summary, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end, though I know our experts on this panel will be able to answer additional questions. We have additional executive orders we are anticipating, but these are the ones that are out at the moment. So with that, Guillermo, I'll turn it back over to the panel.
Great. Thank you so much, Ruth. We hear some background noises, so if you are a speaker and you're not speaking next, I'll ask you to mute yourself, please. So next we have Joe Heyman, who will be discussing the implications and research opportunities created by the new border security executive orders. So, Joe, I turn it to you.
Yes, thank you very much, and thanks to everybody who's listening on the call. You all hear me?
Yes.
Is it working?
Yes. Okay, yes,
good.
Working fine.
I think the thing that has gotten the most, I'm going to speak principally from the point of view of the U.S.-Mexico border. However, there are related issues at the land border with Canada, and, of course, airports and seaports are also in some ways also borders. But I'm going to focus on the U.S.-Mexico border. The border wall has garnered most of the attention. And I think that's deliberate. It's a big, ugly, negative political symbol. I don't want to say that it's not going to have real human rights impacts because it will in some ways, but it shouldn't distract us from the enforcement issues at and near the border. I think the border walls biggest impact is going to be on the treatment of private property owners and, relatedly, local governments in the border region. That's part of the reason the existing border fence/wall is so patchy, and I expect a lot of things to be shoved down people's throats, especially in the state of Texas. So there is important work to be done to document local property owner rights and the process of expropriation. The expansion of expedited removal is really quite extraordinary. This 100 miles of a land or sea border covers most of the population of the country. It's been applied in the heavy-handedest way at the Mexican border. It's been applied sometimes at the Canadian border, but we really need to try to identify the use of expedited removal. The idea that expedited removal is going to be applied to people who can't prove that they've been here more than 2 years is also quite extraordinary, because somebody might be removed before they can go about proving that. And the thing about expedited removal that some listeners may know, but not everybody may know, is that it essentially turns immigration enforcement, Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, or ICE into both a police and judge, or prosecutor and judge. There's no due process in it whatsoever. So the challenge with expedited removal is demonstrating, documenting that in some cases it's applied to people who are not just recent violators of the border. And it's not easy to envision an effective methodology for doing that, partly because it's in the nature of expedited removal that a lot of people are going to be taken away without leaving no trace. But I would bring it to the listeners out there to think about how we can document the use of expedited removal beyond its original intent, which was people who are caught immediately crossing the border. I happen to think we shouldn't have it at all, but certainly this expansion is quite extraordinary, and we need to push back on that. Another thing that was mentioned was the heightened standards for asylum screening, for protection screening, the first step of asylum, which is the credible fear interview or reasonable fear. Now, this is not just a matter at borders, but because so many Central Americans are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, we have already documented a lot of effort by Customs and Border Protection, not Border Patrol, but the Customs and Border Protection officers, to discourage people at ports of entry. Likewise, and the American Immigration Council, in fact, in a report in January 13th of this year, provides a lot of important information. Likewise, there's a pattern of generally trying to dissuade or coerce potential asylum applicants, sometimes by the Border Patrol, often by Customs and Border Protection, later in the process by ICE. And a key task for us is going to be showing that some credible asylum applicants have been coerced or discouraged. Again, the challenge being that many of them will have been removed from the country, and therefore we need to think about perhaps methodologies for collecting information on this in Central America. One of the things we're finding here that was not quite mentioned in the executive order, but relates both to asylum, relates to Central Americans, and relates to the executive order having to do with requiring detention, which I'll talk about in just a moment, is family separation, and in particular, the separation of males from families. We also see the separation of children. We see the separation of women from the rest of the family. So I don't want to say it's only males, but there is a very gendered idea that men are not caretakers, and men don't need humanitarian care. And so one of the things I think would be worth doing is taking a look at documenting the importance of men as caretakers and the effects of separation of men from the rest of the family. The executive order is attempting to prioritize CBP's options, CBP and ICE, because there's an interface between the two of them. It's complex. But attempting to prioritize their options for detentions. There's immediate expedited removal. There's a release for a court date. There's release using a control, like an ankle bracelet. And they're keeping people just in detention. And the executive order seems to be saying that people are either immediately removed or they will be kept in detention. Vox said that there is another option that the Trump administration has proposed. Immigrants can be returned to Mexico while they're waiting for an immigration court to process their case. I don't know how accurate that is, but it would be worth seeing if we can document that. Now, it's not clear that it's actually going to be possible to detain all of these people. CBP has been creating tent cities for 72-hour for short-term holding. The rhetoric was they wanted to end catch and release. The reality is this is an enormous number of people, many of whom have specific requirements under the law, the Wilberforce Act, like unaccompanied minors, or court decisions, the Flores settlement, other such decisions. So it's not clear how they are actually going to move people through this massive detention system. They do say they're going to increase the amount of detention. They say they're going to increase the number of ICE officers. I think we need to begin to trace people through the system and figure out in reality who's detained, who's expelled, who's released, and so forth, and try to understand the consequences of this supposed end of catch and release. The addition of potentially of 5,000 Border Patrol officers and 10,000 ICE officers is very important. I've spent my career actually working on the organizational practices and culture of immigration enforcement officers. And what I think we need to look at is criteria for officer behavior and organizational supervision and evaluation so that we can set standards against which they can be held. We also need to look at how we can collect better information, some sorts of documentation system at the border. There was just recently introduced the Pierce O'Rourke bill. We don't have time to go through it, but I will just mention that when we talk about ICE and we talk about renewal of sanctuary cities in 287G, and we talk about punishing sanctuary cities, we need to know that that's also being, that agenda is being devolved down to the state level. And in fact, it might be more powerful and more effective at the state level than through executive orders such as SB 4 in the state of Texas. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Joe, for your thorough presentation. So next we're going to hear Tom Wong, who will discuss research opportunities around the interior enforcement executive order. Tom?
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for everybody for being on the call today. I want to give everybody time to speak as well as time for questions, so I will try to be as brief as possible. I wanted to start by example. So a recent report that I did with Smith Progress and the National Immigration Law Center focused on, you know, the popular debate around sanctuary jurisdictions. So is there more crime in these sanctuary jurisdictions? How are they doing economically, et cetera? So we know that our current president views sanctuary localities as being places where, quote, you know, crime is bred. And what we wanted to do was bring empirical evidence to bear on this sort of heated political debate. And so fortunately, with our partners at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, they obtained a FOIA that included counties that were tagged as either sanctuary localities or not by ICE. And so with that data set, we were able to merge in crime data as well as economic data to come up with some strong punchlines. So if you haven't seen the report, one of the punchlines is that crime is actually less in sanctuary counties compared to comparable non-sanctuary counties. We sort of think that the mechanism centers on what law enforcement executives have said for decades, that to the extent that local police are doing the work of federal immigration enforcement, there's an erosion of trust with immigrant communities, which makes it more difficult to keep communities safe. Surprisingly, what we saw was a sort of consistent set of results around how sanctuary, how economies are stronger in sanctuary counties. And so by stronger, we're talking about higher median household income, lower poverty, lower public benefits usage, higher employment, lower unemployment. So across the board, using ICE's own classification of sanctuary jurisdictions, we're able to produce these results that were timely around the release of the executive order. What I would encourage all of us to do as researchers is to think strategically. Think about the immigration fights that are ahead, and let's use our collective brain power to think about how we can bring empirical evidence to bear on these immigration policy fights that we know are coming. So this is one example, but of course it's in no way a resolved debate as the sanctuary debate continues. But we were lucky. We were able to get the FOIA data, we were able to analyze that data and push something out immediately after the release of the executive order. So in addition to just encouraging us all to think strategically, here are some thoughts about additional research avenues to explore when it comes to interior immigration enforcement. So as, you know, as already has been said, we as researchers should think about the who, what, when, where, why, and how. So this is akin to descriptive analyses, hopefully using administrative data, so that we can keep the public informed about what enforcement actions are happening. And we know that in most of our work, this descriptive component is only the first step for a deeper analysis. But I think there are strong reasons to believe that this administration will be less forthcoming with administrative data. And so even via filing Freedom of Information Act requests, there may be little confidence that these FOIA requests will actually be met. And so regarding interior immigration enforcement, we already see with this past week of enforcement actions that you know, DACA recipient, or at least a DACA recipient, has been detained. We have seen roughly 75% in terms of DHS's stats, 75% being so-called criminal aliens and 25% not being so-called criminal aliens. We need to do better as researchers. We need to dig deeper. And, again, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, that descriptive part, which I think many of us have left for journalists to do, I think is now partly our role. So moving past the descriptive component, if we're thinking about interior immigration enforcement, I think there are some real opportunities around what the political implications are. So we know that interior immigration enforcement is largely a choice on the part of localities. And so if we are talking about adopting sanctuary policies or not, saying no to detainer requests or not, or a 287G agreement or not, we know that in each locality we have a set of individuals elected to govern who may or may not face electoral implications for their actions. So what are the electoral implications of local cooperation with federal immigration enforcement efforts? This is a question that, of course, will have legs. So to the extent that elected officials are seeing consequences of this sort of partnership, then we can imagine how that might inform their future decision making. There are also other sorts of political implications that we might explore, mostly around governing. So what are the trade-offs that a locality faces when it decides to either double down on cooperation with federal immigration enforcement officials or not? Now, these trade-offs can relate to governing, but it can also segue into a set of questions about economic impact. So I'll just say very briefly that when it comes to interior immigration enforcement, you know, the process from apprehension to detention to subsequent deportation, immigration advocates have for a long time talked about the economic consequences of deportation. I think as researchers, we now have an opportunity to better unpack what those economic implications are. For example, one of the findings in the report that I just mentioned were around public benefits usage, and in particular, the percentage of children under 18 in households that receive public benefits was substantially lower in sanctuary counties. Now, the mechanism is something that I have yet to unpack, and hopefully others will sort of take up this charge. But the narrative is one where if you're seeing increased deportation, you're removing individuals from the workforce. And if these individuals also happen to be the breadwinners within their households, then families become more economically vulnerable. More economically vulnerable families, then, you know, that's where I think the additional research opportunities lie. So what happens when we leave families more economically vulnerable? What happens to local budgets, for example, in terms of public benefits distribution when that happens? What happens to poverty rates, et cetera. So my time is up, but I'll just say that we should not lose sight of what the societal impact of aggressive interior immigration enforcement is. And so in terms of research opportunities here, we can think outside of the framework of administrative data. We can think in qualitative terms. So we need stories to tell. But we can also think in terms of surveys of individuals affected by interior immigration enforcement, surveying businesses and employers of those who are detained and subsequently deported. We can continue doing the work that began a decade ago in terms of surveying law enforcement executives about what they see their role as being when it comes to keeping communities safe versus the question of federal immigration enforcement. And also elite surveys of local elected officials, so that they can help us make an argument for why there should be cooperation or why there should not be cooperation with federal immigration enforcement officials. So, you know, I'll end there. I'm past my time, but I look forward to your questions.
Great. Thank you, Tom, so much. So last but not least, we have Shobhan Wadia, who will focus on the changes to the refugee program as well as the visa ban. Shobhan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to be on this call. I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about what I think the implications of this particular order has been, and I think all of these implications really have natural connections to broader research, and some of the tools have already been highlighted by Tom and others. I think we're all aware of the legal implications of this order. There have been more than 20 lawsuits brought in courts, and many of the challenges have been constitutional, statutory, regulatory. And so when we see a sea of courtroom traffic along these lines, there are normative questions and historical parallels that can be raised, for example, between Fifth Amendment due process in this context and in the wake of 9/11, or the congressional history between particular sections of the Immigration and Nationality Act and how it's being used or misused in this particular context. You know, psychological implications. I feel like I'm seeing this at an equal pace as I am the legal ones. And I think that like with psychology, there's a lot of multidisciplinary implications and research questions that we should be thinking about with regard to the Muslim and refugee ban. So any potential trauma or fear or other implication on those who are not only affected by the ban, but any foreign national who might be conducting research at one of our flagship universities or thinking about coming to do research but now changing plans, what has even been the role and what are even the costs of training and involving counselors and psychologists to react and respond to how this ban is impacting individuals? And I don't even think it's limited to adults, but it certainly includes children as well. Moral implications of a ban like this, certainly the message that we're sending to the rest of the world by banning the entry of immigrants and non-immigrants from 7 countries and suspending our refugee program, I think there are philosophical and moral questions that you might ask. We have a philosophy department here at Penn State. We have a person who thinks about the ethics of borders. And so I think, you know, that's a department that I might connect with as I think about some of the ethical or moral questions that are coming out of the order. Financial, you know, Tom talked a bit about the costs as it relates to families, breadwinners, localities on the interior, but there may very well be financial costs behind this ban, both in terms of the U.S. government having to spend more money for reprocessing or reexamining refugees who were in waiting and who had to wait and then redo certain things like medical exams, for example, or screening, but also the financial costs that this ban might have on our trade, on our tourism, research, academia. Where are the future tuition dollars going in light of this ban? And there may even be a way to manage and handle that empirically. Some of the residual effects of this ban, ones that are less related to the individual people impacted, but more of what, you know, I might be seeing in town or on campus, or we might be seeing around the country. I've seen more flyers to keep them out, you know, flurried around bulletin boards in my college town and on campus. You know, what are some of the First Amendment questions we might ask around that campaign? Again, how are these residual effects tied to earlier historical points where we've seen the same? I think there's an interesting story and question to be told about both the surge of volunteers that have come out after this ban, but also the role of lawyers and big law. There's an interesting story right there, I think. And if we even look at some of the major cases involving exclusion historically, like the Chinese exclusion case, you know, that was a case that was handled by a smart legal team. So, you know, this is almost the turnaround or the flip of no counsel or access to counsel. And, you know, what are the implications when you actually do have counsel? And, you know, is that enough? What should be repeated? What are the cautionary notes? Religion, I think there's a lot of different directions to go just on the implications on religious identity, the relationship between keeping countries or particular religions out and the other measures and arguably contrarian statements and protections we have in place for those who are fleeing religious persecution or in the establishment clause. The role of courts, I think that is a relevant research question. Are we going to see a major crack in the plenary power doctrine? Is the next chapter going to be reviewability of cases that are built on national security, but that have no rational basis? I think that's a new story or one to be continued. Students, scholars, and universities, I think the research questions around, wow, if we look at the ruling that came out of the Ninth Circuit last week, we see that the injury to universities, research, scholars was significant to the finding around standing. you know, what is the future role of universities in responding and reacting to this order? What are some historical events we can point to, such as the wake of 9/11 when students were driven in vans for registration interviews, or during student protests historically? What are some of the connections that we can make there? And then just a few other points, the law and medicine point. Today, a statement came out by a few medical associations on the impact of these orders. From the medical point of view, what are the connections there? Chaos and confusion, right? We've seen that as a headline quite a few times in the wake of this executive order. And I think one connection that we can make is that this isn't the first time we've seen chaos and confusion in the government and on the ground. So if we look at, for example, domestic special registration after 9/11, you know, USCIS offices were ill-equipped to even handle registration interviews, were taken off their regular duties, such as green card applications and naturalization applications. Are we seeing just an elevated version of chaos and confusion at the local or on the ground level? What does that teach us about our immigration bureaucracy, and what are some of the relevant questions to be asked? So in terms of how we can have a set of questions or an agenda that is not just defensive but is also offensive, I think having a conversation about some of the legislative response, what it should be, what it could be, or even the role of movements could be useful. So, for example, in the new year, Senator Booker introduced legislation rejecting any type of tracking system based on religion, nationality, citizenship, and so on. In the wake of 9/11, a series of congressional members issued a bill called the Civil Liberties Restoration Act, and it really was meant to repeal some of the administrative actions that were made in the name of national security after 9/11. But what I'll say about the CLRA is that it had a positive role in that it served as a tool for going on offense in response to a lot of these actions. And then to the extent that this is all being dubbed in the name of national security, you know, to what extent can comprehensive immigration reform really be the national security solution? We've seen that in white papers. We've seen that. We've seen legislation on the Hill. We may not for a while. So now is a good time for it to make a good conversation in a law review or journal to actually document how restorative or immigration reform can improve national security. Let me just end with some of the audiences that I think we're trying to reach beyond academia. Some I mentioned in our previous call, which was a little bit more focused on a Muslim registry or NSEERS, but the tech industry. I mean, I suppose we could look at all the plaintiffs amici in the various lawsuits and find our brand new audiences or existing audiences that we should continue to build relationships with. I would certainly put the technology sector in there, dreamers, Congress, universities, state attorney generals, who've been extremely vocal in response to this executive order, big law, national security experts. I mean, how many times do we see Madeleine Albright on an amicus brief? Former George W. Bush officials, including, you know, judges and leaders and former DHS secretaries. I think we have a broad audience for our research, and I look forward to your questions and hope I didn't go over time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Hova. So now I will open the floor for questions. If you do have a question, I'll ask you to unmute your phone first by pressing star 6, then introduce yourself and say whom you're asking the question to. Any questions? I wonder if people people are having trouble unmuting themselves. Yes. Can you please hit star 6 if you have a question? I think we're having some technical issues.
Oh, this is Farhad Sipna. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, this is Farhad Sipna from Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. How are you all?
Good.
Good. Thanks for having this conversation here today. I will say this, and if all the commenters can address this question, I'd be very grateful. What I'm hearing so far is stuff that we already know. I'm very sorry to say that. I'll be very straightforward about it. What I am looking for as a practitioner, looking at people every day, day in and day out, coming to my office, scared to death, is where do you think we are going from here? I'd like to know your opinions, what you think, even if it's obviously just your opinion, any informed information that you have, so we have something in our hands to give to clients and to plan ahead as to what might happen. For example, when I take a client next week to ICE to report, what can I expect? If I have a client who has a DREAM Act EAD card that needs to be renewed, should I file that application? Things of that sort that are concrete, which could help practitioners like me in the field. Thank you very much.
This is Joe Hyman. I've got a couple of replies to that. One of them is that people need to be prepared to block expedited removal, because you're not going to be able to do anything for your client if they're rapidly put into the system and removed. That it's probably more of a problem at the border, both land borders, but it may be occurring all over. They're talking about expanding the period up to 2 years. This is tricky because a person who demonstrates that they've been without authorization for 2 years means that they're then subject to other crimes and bars, but expedited removal is the unaccountable, unchallengeable mechanism that they're going to use for something like mass deportation. Another thing that, and maybe the lawyers here will be able to talk about this more, but the basic constitutional rights that govern search and seizure apply to all persons. And so this effort to either turn local and state police into immigration enforcement officers, or to do pickups, just sort of casual pickups, if they're going after somebody that they have an order, a final order removal, but they also pick up other people, seems like it might be challengeable on grounds of lack of basis for search and seizure. But I say that as a non-lawyer.
Right.
This is Shoba. I can respond to some of those questions, and I appreciate the question and would also suggest that part of the goal for this call was to raise some of the research questions that academics might be thinking about in light of these orders. But in terms of the practical advice, you know, in quotes, you know, my philosophy is that I do not want to answer questions about what may happen in the future, because I'm so inundated about what we know right now. And so I think sharing the information that we do have, identifying what might be uncertain, and for any individual, the risk barometer is going to look different, and that barometer is going to depend on whether they're from one of these affected countries, whether they're from a Muslim-majority country, or their own experiences. So in some ways, it's a choice that they need to make, understanding the risks. I think two other affirmative things that we can be doing with individuals and communities is safety planning and knowing your rights and responsibilities. So, you know, I'm suggesting that anybody who travels, you know, when making and after making that decision, has their Know Your Rights card, has information about an immigration lawyer, has a plan for an immigration attorney at the airport that they might be returning to, depending on where they might be from, and also has a plan for their family. So that just might be some of the tools that the points that can be made. In terms of what's happening in your own jurisdiction or on the ground, some of that is going to be through local AILA chapters or within the immigration bar where you live in terms of, for example, what's happening when I take my client to a report to the local ICE office because they are under an OSUP. So that's my brief answer.
Great. Thank you, Shobha, so much. And thank you for reminding us of, like, the focus of this call. And I want to encourage people to ask questions about the speaker's presentation, but about the focus of this call, which is research ideas and some other suggestions along those lines. So do we have other questions?
Hi, this is Michelle Wazan from the American Immigration Council. Thanks to everybody for your presentations. I have a question, and it's about data availability. I know that there are concerns about what data will be made available by DHS and other agencies, and if we're going to have the ability to access that data to do some of this research. Some places have, and some individuals have taken it upon themselves to start downloading stuff now to make sure that somebody has the data in case it disappears from different websites. But I'm just curious if any of you have thoughts about this, who is downloading that data and where can other researchers find it, and what do you think about data availability moving forward?
Thank you, Michelle. Any takers?
This is Royce. I guess I don't know offhand. We can perhaps follow up with folks if there is a publicly shareable location where organizations have been downloading data, though I would encourage folks to definitely download what is most important to them if they have been using data from any of the agencies. And not take for granted that it will remain online, as Mr. Shell suggested. I think we're all preparing for the worst. I mean, we have certainly not gotten any specific intel that the data sharing will change. And I know that there are different interactions with the government going forward who will continue to push for that transparency. And I think we may need to wait and see when there are leaders fully in charge of the agencies, and even at the department level going beyond just Secretary Kelly, for them to see how this is rolling out. But if others have more specific information about what they expect, please share.
Thank you, Royce. Do we have any other questions?
This is Shobha. I mean, Tom's point about qualitative data, I think it will, you know, it remains to be seen to what extent that's going to emerge as a primary source of data and analysis going forward. I just haven't done enough data inquiries since inauguration to know how or if it might change. And some of the data inquiries have always been challenging, like FOIA, for example. It might also depend on how many civil servants who believe in making data available remain in the government, and see their job, in a narrower way than our president, right? So, I'm hopeful, for example, unless there's a 180, who knows? You know, the Office of Immigration Statistics at the Department of Homeland Security has a fair amount of information, much of which is empirical. And then we have individual demographers and sociologists at our universities that will rely on other things like American Community Survey to generate analyses and data. I can say for my part, Michelle, not that you're necessarily looking for this, every FOIA I've ever made and all the data I've received from them in the last decade and a half around discretion and deferred action is available and downloadable at my website.
Guillermo, if I can quickly add just one last thing from, this is Royce, that I can tell you from folks, there are definitely folks on Capitol Hill who are eager to have much of the data remain available. And so if it is pulled down, another way to get at some of this data would be to reach out to local congressional offices or Senate offices to ask them to make the request basically on your behalf and make clear that it would be able to be shared.
Great. So do we have other questions? I do have a question for Tom, and Joe to some extent also mentioned this, which is the idea of documenting enforcement actions in local communities. And I was wondering if there are efforts in the works about like coordinating with other researchers, sharing information and resources, methodologies, and trying to maximize the impact that, of the work that people are doing individually and creating like more stable structures for doing this kind of documentation. I don't know if you can, if you are aware of that or you're part of any networks right now.
So thanks for the question. I think it speaks to the need for deeper collaboration and coordination among researchers who are concerned about immigration policy under a Trump administration. When it comes to data on interior immigration enforcement, I think a lot of us can see what data is necessary, but as Shobha mentioned, it's not going to be forthcoming, particularly given the signals already sent by this administration. So, you know, to map this out, we would want to be able to get geocoded data on apprehensions, where individuals are subsequently detained, and when those individuals are deported, what they're leaving behind. So leaving behind in terms of property as well as family members, et cetera. So if we think about this process that runs from apprehension to deportation, we want to be able to have as much administrative data as we can on this process. That's what gives us as researchers the tools to answer important research questions related to the political, social, and economic implications of aggressive interior immigration enforcement. But in the absence of that, I don't see how researchers you know, working in silos can put together the necessary sort of data points in order to tell the story systematically. I know that there are individuals who are actively, you know, interviewing in a qualitative context the family members of those held in detention and, you know, the family members of those being deported. I think those efforts are important. They definitely inform the debate. But my sort of hope is that we can coordinate on getting administrative data from DHS so that we can tell the story systematically. And I don't know if this is currently happening. And even if there was interest among researchers to do this, I don't know if the data would be forthcoming.
Great. Thank you. Joe, do you have any thoughts on collaboration? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think the thrust of your point, Guillermo, was very important, and this is an agenda that we should be doing in, you know, the 25 hours a day that we have. But getting a real framework for collecting documentation, I think, is of great importance of legal and human rights abuses and many other things, and starting to get consistent codes. There is some collected data that Southern Border Communities Coalition did. I don't know the current status of that, and it really wasn't done from a social science point of view, but it was certainly done. And it does occur to me as I think about this that state and local jurisdictions also have their equivalent of Freedom of Information Act. So Texas Right to Know Act requests could also be used. Not that I think that Texas is going to be any better than the federal government, but, you know, there are multiple lines for trying to get at information. The other thing that occurs to me is the value of doing interviews of people at points of after they're removed, when they arrive either in Mexico or Central America or other parts of the world, you know, people whose asylum cases have been turned down. And some of those places are very difficult to work in, but there have been some studies that have gathered tremendous amounts of information about who immigrants are, just like you said, Tom, what they leave behind, their whole migration experience coming in and then being arrested and being removed. You know, I think of the work of Dan Martinez and Jeremy Slack on the Mexican border in Mexico City, and I think we certainly need to have that in Central America also.
Great. Thank you. So I think we ran out of time. We're actually a couple minutes over our time limit. So I will end the call here, and I'd like to thank our speakers and all of you for joining us on this call today. Have a great day, everyone, and I hope you can join us for our next call. Thank you.
Thank you.